Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, it's another wonderful night on the Bone Collector, and I'm Patty, the Bone Collector. Tonight we're going to talk about some UFOs, as my Uncle Jimmy used to call them, UFOs. And not just any UFOs, UFOs, but some UFOs from the 1800s, the first UFO sighting in North American continent. I'd say America, but we weren't America yet. We were still a British colony. It's funny how in this day and age, all the UFO sightings, the incidents, everything, the contact that people have had are classified files in the Pentagon and other government agencies. And the government is curious about the UFOs. They are more than likely secretly studying aliens. I believe there is something to Area 51. But as a society here in 2021, we're sitting here waiting to see if those documents will ever be unclassified. We all know that intelligent life, can't just be limited to our planet. I recently read an article that it would take over 200 years for us to travel at the speed of light and get to the outer reaches of all of the known universes that science currently can identify. So I find it very, very hard to believe that we are the only intelligent life out in this massive expanse of space. With that being said, a lot of people, when you talk about UFOs and say, hey, when you hear UFO, what do you think about? And people will more than likely say Roswell, New Mexico, Area 51. There's plenty of shows on television right now. The Mystery of Skinwalker Ranch, which is on the History Channel, waiting for season 2 very patiently. But nobody seems to recognize some of the earlier UFO sightings, which I think is very important. The very first UFO sighting on the North American continent was actually in 1639 by the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony out by Charlestown, Massachusetts. And we find this out because he kept very meticulous recordings in his diary, and he witnessed an unexplained phenomenon in the sky, so we're going to call it a UFO, twice, not just once, but twice. The first time that he witnessed this, him and another gentleman were rowing a boat across the Charles River when they witnessed this incredible shape-shifting light. And it's pretty incredible in what he said that he saw. He said that it came up into the sky, but it wasn't just a light. It was shifting a shape from an arrow darting back and forth to animals and other, you know, curious shapes, which is kind of interesting because usually when we we think about UFOs and unidentified flying objects, spacecraft, however you want to, spaceship, how you want to categorize them, we don't normally think about shape-shifting light, but how else can you explain this? They try to, scientists are trying to explain it as an ignis fatuus, which is kind of like swamp gas. However, it couldn't be swamp gas because he was in a river. There was no decomposing organic matter. He wasn't by a marshland. So it's very interesting that they would pick that. But of course, in the scientific community, sometimes when you can't explain things, you try to fit them into a little box. Instead of saying, we don't know, it could be a UFO, whatever, however you want to say it. Now, that was in March of 1639. He witnessed this again in January of 1644, right off the coast into the cove outside of Boston. And this light that rose right from the water, rose up out of the water, and it shifted into the shape of a man, which, again, goes along with his shape-shifting lights from 1639. But the difference is once these lights shifted into the shape of a man, they took off at a phenomenal rate of speed, and then they were gone. So that would be the very first sighting of UFO activity in the United States. And I, like I said, I call that UFO. It's a unidentified light whizzing through the sky, for lack of better terms, non-scientific. And when you look up into the sky, it just reminds me of a tradition that we now have out in the country on Friday nights, that we go outside and we watch the International Space Station make its way across the night sky over Hamlin, New York. But do you ever wonder how many of those stars and how many of the other moving lights in the sky are actually just stars or planets or the International Space Station? How do we know that that's really what we're looking at? Now, the second notable sighting that I wanted to talk about tonight was the 1800 sighting in Baton Rouge, Louisiana by then Vice President Thomas Jefferson. He wasn't just the vice president, he was also the president of the American Philosophical Society, and they had a newsletter that they put out that was the Transactions of the American Philosophical Society. And the whole event that Thomas Jefferson witnessed was published in their newsletter. And he gets into great detail. Unfortunately, if you look up the article from the newsletter, when he describes it, he says it appears to be the size of a large house, 70 or 80 feet long and of a form nearly resembling figure 5 in plate 5, though I can't find what figure 5 in plate 5 is. because I can't find any illustration to show what that is, which is kind of disappointing. So when we talk about this one, it is seen by many people, passing over the heads of spectators. And it says that the beams of light come down to the ground on one side of the people, but on the other side, the stars are visible. So it's not it's not a encompassing light of the whole area around them. It's actually beams of light shooting to the ground. And they said that these lights and the passing of the lights among the people, there's heat coming off of the lights, but there's no electric sensation. So there's no like lightning, as you would think that the lights coming down from the sky would be more like lightning. And it's funny because this is a high government official in the United States who freely puts out this information on what he saw. And now in this day and age, if a high ranking government official, we see this with our military who encounter UFO, especially our Air Force pilots, even airline pilots. They are taken immediately into a debriefing meeting and told that none of this happened. They are not to talk about this. But yet this information was freely shared among everybody that could read and had access to this newsletter. Now, after he saw the phenomenon and it streaked across the sky, it disappeared from view, but then they heard this rushing sound and the sound of trees being tore up and everything, and this craft appeared to have crashed, though two men on an expedition were unable to find any wreckage of this crash. Now, those were two incidents that briefly I could talk about as early incidents, but one of the most intriguing, and I think most interesting, and actually one of my favorite early UFO encounters actually has its 124th anniversary tomorrow on April 17th, 1897. And this is the Aurora, Texas incident. This actually was covered in the newspaper several days after it happened. What the events on April 17th unfolded at about 6 a.m. and they were mainly centered around the property of Judge Proctor. The UFO was coming through the sky, and they say that it sounded like it was having some kind of trouble with its propulsion because it was not going very fast and it was losing altitude. And as it was losing altitude, it swept closely above the town square until it crashed into the windmill on Judge Proctor's farm. It destroyed the windmill and it pretty much, the spacecraft just broke into a million pieces. It was not very salvageable. The townsfolk came right to the crash site. It was definitely startling at 6 a.m. to be woken up by, I can imagine, the sound of this craft hitting a windmill and just exploding into pieces on impact. And when the townspeople got there, they discovered that there was a pilot inside the craft and he was badly injured. It was obvious to them that he was not of this world. He did not look human. He did not have any mannerisms that you would believe that he was human. And at the time, they were doing the dirigibles and the aircraft and the air, different ways of experimenting on flying. And most of it was with the dirigibles and the hot air balloons and things like that. And those were often misidentified as a spacecraft or an unidentified flying object. And when they would crash, they would find that it was actually a human piloting it. But the townspeople found that he was definitely not from this earth. The first thing that they did was rescue him from the wreckage, and they took them to a barn on Proctor's farm, and reportedly he died very soon after. And instead of trying to capitalize on the event, they gave him a Christian burial in a local cemetery. They placed a headstone on his grave, gave it a little epitaph from numerous articles that I read. They named him Ned, though I'm not sure how they came up with that name, but they named him Ned. And they drew this rudimentary spacecraft, the cigar-shaped with the little windows, that was engraved on the headstone as well. 2 days after the crash, the first article appeared in the Dallas Times Herald. And the reason for that is they didn't want this to become a media sensation. They didn't feel that, I guess they didn't feel that it was something that they wanted to draw a lot of attention to their town. They didn't want to disrupt the peaceful rest of the pilot of the spaceship. So they waited to even leak any of the information out. By the time the media got there, the newspaper people, anybody, authorities, got to Aurora, Texas, virtually all of the evidence of the crash had been disposed of, either by the residents who took pieces as souvenirs or being thrown down the well that was on the Proctor farm or buried underneath the remains of the windmill. Now, there were several military presences there now in the town. And I think that what makes this more of a credible story is that they didn't want the media coverage. If they had wanted the media coverage, then you would think that it was somehow a hoax, too good to be true. But because they didn't want all of the attention and they didn't want everything coming down on the town, I find it to be a very credible, and some people will say crazy, but I do believe that a spacecraft did crash land in Aurora, Texas. Now, interest within the town has not diminished, but it is not a well-known incident. It's not brought up. It's not something that we celebrate like in Roswell, New Mexico, where they have their alien festivals, UFO festivals, whatever they do. Now, in 1945, Brawley Oates bought the Proctor property, and he took all of the debris from the crash out of the well, because it was intention that he was going to use the well for drinking water. I don't know if I would have even considered that, seeing that if this was an actual UFO craft, knowing what we know now scientifically about the minerals and the contaminants that come from space, if I would actually drink from that well. And he began to have some health issues after he cleaned the well and started to use it, and really became convinced that it was contaminated by the wreckage from the spaceship. So what he did in 1957 is he sealed off the well with concrete and then placed a shed on top of it. In the 1970s, there was a renewed interest in the case. The International UFO Bureau and the media really got to thinking on whether or not this was something that was real, that really happened. So a scan was done of the grave with some deep soil, you know, radar and things like that. And it was determined that the grave was as old as it should have been, and that there was no reason to believe that it didn't contain the remains of an extraterrestrial being. However, the only proof that they could have that would 100% say that this was a being from another planet was to exhume the body and do a full medical examination. The town still protects the pilot of the spaceship, because they normally, a court can order an exhumation of a body for examination. However, the town passed the law stating that an exhumation of remains from a local cemetery could only be authorized by, or permission given by, the next of kin. This is a space alien. He's from another planet. No next of kin, obviously. How would you reach them? So he is protected because there's nobody to give permission to dig up his body. So those remains, whatever is in that grave, it are 100% dead from being dug up. We have to go by what the townspeople in 1897 happened. And the story goes on from there. The story will always live that is the final resting place of a true space pilot. A piece of metal was found that supposedly was from the wreckage at an old gas station on what was part of Proctor's property. And they did a metallurgy test on it, and they found that it was composed primarily of iron, but the metal was not magnetic at all, which goes against the properties of the iron. And it wasn't brittle like iron. It was more of a high-grade aluminum, which in 1897 there was no capability of being produced in the United States. And even now today, in the article that I read for this was in 2011, it was very hard to manufacture then. So we can only assume that because it is, even though it is elements made from elements that are available on Earth, the manufacture of these elements into one type of metal is highly unlikely. It would, and if it is the piece of metal from 1897, it was impossible to manufacture at that time. So there's a pretty intriguing story. Now, the town still gives tours of the local cemetery. They tell the story about the alien, but it is only a local phenomenon. It's not something that tourists flock to. Not too long ago, though, somebody did steal the headstone off of his grave, but I believe that that has been returned. So it's very intriguing, I guess, that we can believe the stories that happened back in 1800. We can believe what is written in the newspapers in 1897. And we were allowed to have these stories. We were allowed to have the Vice President of the United States share his experience with the UFOs then. But when you try to research UFOs and extraterrestrial contacts and things like that past the Roswell incident, it becomes very difficult. So I guess we just stay with the past and learn from the past on these alien encounters and hope that sooner than later at least, the government will release some of these documents and we'll be able to see actually what they know, because I do believe that they know a lot more than they're letting on. So that's our early UFO encounters show. I'm still trying to get back in the swing of things, so pardon for the delays in my speaking and my thought process and things like that. We're getting back into the groove. It's been about 9 years since I last did my podcast regularly, but I am very excited to get these started again. And I think next week is going to be pretty interesting. I haven't decided if we're going to talk about witches or exactly what we're going to discuss next week, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be something it'll be something interesting and hopefully thought-provoking and get you guys talking and get you out to some of my events that are coming up. I do have my books on sale at the Under the Apple Tree Antique Shop, which is in Clarkston, New York. But you can also, for those of you who are not in the area, they are available on my Facebook page, These Old Bones. Also, I'm going to be at the Thousand Island Comic Con in July 17th and 18th in Watertown. And also on, for my Rochester listeners, I will be at the South Wedge Farmers Market every Thursday nights from 4 to 7. Also, I'm available. Just shoot me a message if there's anything that you would request the show on or you'd like to see me write about in one of my books or on my blog. I would definitely enjoy a little message. And I hope you enjoyed our show on UFOs.